like gobbledygook. Not to me. I understood exactly what she meant. She meant that we were kindred spirits, that we understood each other, and that we helped each other make sense of ourselves and of our lives. We've been quacking ever since. I know for certain that I'll always have Emma's back, and that she'll have mine too. And trust me, Emma's a good person to have looking out for you, not least because she has a mean right hook, as I found out to my detriment one day. We were filming Chamber of Secrets when the Prisoner of Azkaban book came out. True to form, I was one of the very last members of the cast to read it, but word reached me that it included a scene in which Hermione gives Draco a well-deserved slap in the face. Cool. This should be fun. I was very into my Jackie Chan films at the time, and was stoked to learn that Emma and I might have to indulge in some on-screen violence when we shot the next film the following year. So as soon as I heard this, Josh and I went to find her so we could practice our stage fighting. There was a holding tent just off set, a bit like a wedding marquee. This was where we kids could hang out when we didn't have to be on set or in tutoring. To start with, it was amply stocked with chocolate, crisps, Coca-Cola, and, believe it or not, Red Bull, which I mischievously encouraged the younger kids to indulge in. It was free, after all. That soon changed when the mum of Matthew Lewis, who played Neville Longbottom, made the not unreasonable observation that me feeding unlimited chocolate and energy drinks to 9-year-olds was not the best idea in the history of ideas. Once again, my reputation with the chaperones was consolidated. The snacks, to our disappointment, morphed into fresh fruit and water, and the holding tent became a tad less inviting. But it did have a ping pong table, and Emma, being a mean ping pong player, was often to be found there. Josh and I burst into the holding tent. Sure enough, Emma was hanging out there with another girl playing ping pong. My imagination was sparked by the thought of enacting the perfect Jackie Chan stage slap, where the cameras are perfectly lined up from behind me to make it look as if her palm has made solid contact with my face, and I really sell it on screen even though Emma hasn't even touched me. Not even close. So I approached with an abundance of enthusiasm. Interior, the holding tent, day. Tom and Josh hover around the ping pong table waiting for Emma to crush her opposition. She looks somewhat perplexed by the manic glint in their eyes. Tom. Do you want to practice slapping me? Emma, brow furrowed. Excuse me? Tom. Because in the next film, that's what you do. You slap me. Lying through his teeth. I just read it. Emma. Okay, great. Tom, mansplaining. Right, so here's what you do. You need to stand there. You need to use your body. You need to put everything into it to sell it. You need to... While Tom is talking, Emma calmly sizes him up, raises one hand, and not realising that he was talking about a stage slap, cracks him as hard as she can across the cheek. Beat. Emma. Like that? Tom blinks, heavily. He's holding back tears. Tom, in a clipped voice. Great. Yeah, that's good. That's great. Well done. Nice one. See you later, yeah? He turns his back on Emma and sheepishly exits the tent, his tail firmly tucked. I didn't have the cojones to tell Emma that I hadn't meant her to thwack me in the face or that she nearly had me in tears. She didn't find that out till much later on. And when, the following year, we came to filming that scene, you can imagine my hesitation when they told me the slap had been rewritten into a punch. I pleaded with Emma to make very sure she was keeping her distance for our stage punch. I don't mind admitting that my cheek twinged at the memory of Emma Watson's previous right hook. Emma has taught me so many valuable lessons over the years. Most importantly, don't always follow the herd. Never underestimate the power of a woman. And whatever you do, keep quacking. Chapter 17. The Weasel Bees at Work, or Golfing with Gryffindorks. There were times when we kids were shepherded back and forth from set in a big bus. Imagine a regular rowdy school trip, except the passengers are decked out not in their school uniform, but in wizard robes and wands. I'm 13 years old, and some of my Harry Potter wages have purchased me a portable CD player and a Limp Bizkit CD. I'm sitting on the bus next to Rupert Grint, their track Break Stuff blaring over my headphones. Maybe you know Limp Bizkit. If so, you might reasonably be of the opinion that it's not completely suitable for 13-year-olds. The themes are adult, the language is fruity. It was right up my street. I glanced to my right where Rupert was quietly minding his own business. It occurred to me that I might be able to get him to break out into a full-blown Ron Weasley expression of bemused astonishment. So I took off my headphones and put them over his ears. His brow furrowed. His eyes widened. And as he heard the full wallop of Limp Bizkit's lyrics, that classic Ron expression spread over his face. You know the one. I might as well have dropped a spider in his lap. When I remember that incident, I'm reminded of two truths. One is that there was a reason why most of the chaperoning mums had a moment or two when I was not their favourite person. Remember the skateboard? Remember the Red Bull? I was, I think, an occasionally disruptive influence on some of the younger kids, whether by distributing sweets or exposing their sons and daughters to the more explicit side of American rap music. The other is that the actors who played the Weasleys were everything that you wanted them to be in real life. Funny, kind, and laid back, and none more so than Rupert. I had, of course, met Mark Williams, who played Mr. Weasley, when I was filming The Borrowers. On Potter, we rarely saw each other. Our scenes tended not to coincide, so my contact with him was limited to premieres and press junkets. But those early memories I have of him, pre-Potter, recall an actor who was forever larking about. He was relaxed on set and keen to make everyone around him feel similarly relaxed. He always seemed to be the first to acknowledge that we were not doing anything particularly important. We were just making films. So it was okay to have fun in the process. Mark was the perfect counterfoil for Julie Walters, who played Mrs. Weasley, much to my mum's excitement. While she was the queen of kindness on set, she also had a mischievous sense of humour, and she and Mark were forever mucking around. They were both warm and incredibly down to earth. They were, in short, the perfect Weasleys. I'm sure they were a good part of the reason why Rupert, along with James and Ollie Phelps, who played Fred and George, had such a sense of fun on set. When the Weasleys were together, they were always relaxed and having a good time. On screen, Rupert and I were bitter enemies. Off screen, I had, and have, nothing but love for the Ginger Ninja. It was almost impossible not to feel that way. From the very beginning, he was always completely hilarious. This is the guy who got the part after sending in a video of himself rapping the immortal line, "Hello there, my name is Rupert Grint. I hope you like this, and don't think I stink." He was, unsurprisingly, extremely Ron-like. He was incredibly cheeky, with a habit of blurting out vaguely inappropriate comments that most people would have suppressed. He had a massive, and quite expensive, problem with laughing on set, thanks to Chris Columbus's red card system that cost him several thousand pounds. Corpsing on set is an occupational hazard for actors, especially young ones. All it takes is for somebody to say the wrong thing or to catch your eye in a certain way. And it doesn't matter how many stern words you receive or how many legendary actors you are working with, it's almost impossible not to dissolve into fits of laughter each time the cameras start to turn. Of all of us, Rupert was by far the most susceptible to that. Rupert always seemed entirely unbothered by anything. Despite all the pressures he's been under from day one of Potter, I've never heard him complain or appear to be even slightly pissed off with the occasional downsides of being in the public eye. He's just a good, sweet-natured person, seemingly able to take anything and everything in his stride. He's much less starry than you might imagine an actor of his profile to be. And although the characters we played despised each other, offset, I always felt we had a good deal in common. We both did the same thing with our wages. We enjoyed them, wholeheartedly. Go to either of our houses and you'll find crazy trinkets galore. I bought a dog. He bought a llama. Two, actually, which in a couple of years turned into 16. Llamas mate enthusiastically, apparently. He bought a nice set of wheels, just as I did. But whereas I got myself a soft-top Beamer, roof down, even in near-freezing conditions, he fulfilled a childhood ambition to be an ice cream man by quietly spending his hard-earned on a fully loaded ice cream van, which he spontaneously turned up to work in and started giving out free ice creams. He even used to drive around sleepy villages, distributing ice creams to kids astonished at being handed a 99 by Ron Weasley in the flesh. It was crazy, but somehow entirely characteristic of Rupert. Despite everything, he didn't know how to be anything but himself. Everyone changes a little as they grow up. As we were making the later films, Rupert became a little quieter, and his playfulness became a little more reserved. But he never lost his authenticity or his gentle, genuine nature. And in later years, of all the friends I made on the set of Harry Potter, he's the one who has shared my passion for certain projects. For a number of Christmases now, I've headed off to Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital in London to hand out presents to the kids who find themselves in hospital over the festive period. I start the day by going to Hamley's Toy Shop, yes, the one I used to go to after auditions with my mum, and do my best to blag as much Potter merchandise as possible. Then off to the hospital with a Santa sack full of toys. On one occasion, I texted Rupert the night before to ask him if he'd come along with me. It sounds like a small thing. It is a small thing compared to what some of those kids in hospital have to go through. But I was very aware that for Daniel, Emma, and Rupert, more so even than for the rest of us, the question of charity work is a difficult one. We have the ability to help people simply by turning up. Sometimes we don't even have to turn up at all. Daniel, for example, can sign 10 photos and make thousands of pounds for a charity overnight. So while most people have a very good reason why they might not want to devote big chunks of precious spare time to charitable causes, our reasons are less convincing. It is, of course, a quiet privilege to do what we can for those less fortunate than we are, but that privilege comes with an uncomfortable question. Where do you draw the line? Where do you stop? There's no shortage of people in need of help, and it would be easy to beat yourself up for not doing more. Like all of us, Rupert does what he can to leverage his profile for good causes. But it would have been quite understandable if my last-minute request for Great Ormond Street had been one request too many. Not least because I know how it crushes him to see children who are not well. But, ever enthusiastic, he turned up the next day with his partner. No management team, no driver, no fuss, just modest, nonchalant Rupert. Happy to give his time to brighten the days of some kids whose days sorely needed brightening. That's Rupert in a nutshell. Quirky, cheeky, thoughtful, reliable, kind. And a good guy to know if you fancy an ice cream. Fred and George Weasley were played by the Phelps twins, James and Ollie. They're a couple of years older than me, so there was no chance of shocking them with a blast of gangster rap. It took me almost a decade to work out which was which, and I certainly never risked calling them by their names, in case I got it wrong. But although we didn't find ourselves in many scenes together, we developed a friendship that endures to this day. Both are as warm and funny as their characters. Give Fred and George an inch of fun, and they'll take a mile of it. James and Ollie shared this trait with the fictional twins. They were always extremely good at making the most of any given situation. If there's a joke to be made, they'll make it. If there's something to blag, they'll blag it. When we were making the later films, the filmmakers wanted to shoot numerous behind-the-scenes features as bonus material. They suggested going to everybody's houses and filming them going about their daily muggle activities, walking the dog, washing the car, mowing the lawn, and so forth. Mostly, we were unenthusiastic about these suggestions. The Phelps boys had other ideas, and they had a very Fred and George way of suggesting it. They played golf, as did Rupert, and I had also just started to enjoy hacking a white ball around. "Why don't we all go to play golf somewhere iconic?" they casually suggested. "And they can film that. How about, say, the Celtic Manor in Wales, a very popular golfing destination that was about to host the Ryder Cup on their brand new, impossible-to-get-onto course?" Much to our delight, they fell for it. And so James, Ollie, Rupert and I prepared to road trip our way to the Celtic Manor. But hang on! Surely it wouldn't work if there were other golfers ahead or behind us, the twins helpfully pointed out. We would have a camera crew with us who would only get in the way of other golfers. A brilliant idea seemed to arrive spontaneously. "Wouldn't it be much more sensible if we were to have the whole course to ourselves?" they said, almost in unison. Their cunning observation was taken on board, and the upshot was that one of the most desirable golf courses in the world was booked out for a whole day, simply for the four of us to hack away at. As in every golfing contest we've ever had, the Weasleys won. Bloody Gryffindorks. Chapter 18. Draco and Harry, or Two Sides of the Same Coin. Nobody knows Nobody can ever know what it's like to be Daniel Radcliffe. There isn't a single person in the whole Potter project who had more pressure on him or her than Daniel. From the moment he was cast, he was never really allowed to be a muggle kid. Not really. And while the same was true for Emma and Rupert, for Daniel, the spotlight was just that little bit more intense. He was the boy who lived, after all, but he was also the boy who would never live a normal life. I had the privilege, like most ordinary teenagers, of being able to make some shitty decisions in my youth. The worst repercussions for me were having a Polaroid mugshot hung up on an office wall in HMV Guildford. For Daniel, the consequences of being a regular teenage hooligan would have been so much weightier. Almost from day one, people were taking pictures of him, secretly trying to record him, trying to catch him in a compromising or vulnerable position. At no point did he, could he, give them the opportunity to do so. The weight of the films rested almost solely on his shoulders. I have such respect for the way he learned to cope with that pressure and such love for him as a person. Of all the grand names I found myself surrounded by during my time on the Potter films, it's Daniel from whom I've perhaps learnt the most and in whom I see myself to the greatest extent. Perhaps that seems strange, given that we were cast partly because of our similarities to the roles we played. Harry and Draco are enemies from the off, after all. But I don't see it that way. I would say Harry and Draco are two sides of the same coin, and I see myself and Daniel in a similar way. We mostly kept our distance at first. Whenever we saw each other around set, we limited ourselves to a characteristically British nod of the head and a, "Morning, you alright? Sweet." While I was busy larking around with the Slytherin lads, Daniel was busy being busy. Our paths didn't cross as much as you might imagine. When our paths did cross, what struck me about him was his fierce intelligence. An almost savant-like memory for obscure cricket stats and Simpsons trivia. We'd sit on our broomsticks between takes while the crew reset a scene doing Simpsons quizzes, and nobody had a deeper knowledge of niche facts than Daniel. As the films progressed, we grew friendlier and started seeing each other a lot more. I'd go round to his house from time to time to watch the cricket, get a pizza, and probably smoke too many cigarettes. We were definitely two youngsters who were smoking before our time. A visitor to Leavesden would have a good chance if they were to wander behind one of the dodgy old warehouses and look under a tower of scaffolding of seeing Harry, Draco and Dumbledore huddled together against the cold, drinking tea and enjoying what we euphemistically referred to as a breath of fresh air. The more I got to know Daniel, the more I saw how similar we were in so many ways. We're both hyper-aware of our surroundings and the emotions of others. We're both emotionally very sensitive, easily affected by the energy around us. It always seemed to me, and it still does, that if I had been an only child like Daniel, free from the influence of three older brothers, I would have ended up a lot more like him. And if Daniel had enjoyed the wayward influence of Jink, Chris, and Ash, it wouldn't surprise me if he'd have ended up a lot more like me. And there is a symmetry to that, because I think the same is maybe true of Harry and Draco. I would never have understood this in the early days of Potter, but as the films progressed, it became increasingly apparent to me. And one of the reasons it became apparent to me, I see now, was Daniel's developing skill as an actor. Daniel will be the first to admit that when we all started out, none of us really knew what we were doing. Sure. He and I had been on film sets before, but how good can somebody that young really be? Daniel, however, wanted to get better from the get-go. He always looked back on his previous work with a bit of a frown, and he had the admirable quality of knowing he could cruise through the role on autopilot, but not wanting to. He cared deeply, and from day one, he set about becoming the very best actor he could be. Which is quite a task when you've been given the role of Harry Potter. In my opinion, it was the hardest part to play. Harry is and always was the staple, the solid ground, the reliable character. He has to be like that for the rest of us to dance around him. Draco's aloofness, Ron's jokes, Hermione's sharp wit, Hagrid's bumbling kindness, Voldemort's wickedness, Dumbledore's wisdom. All of these are thrown into relief by Harry's constant, unwavering solidness. It takes a special kind of skill to achieve that solidness and still draw the eye and move the audience. Daniel learned fast and learned well. He quickly became a very special actor. Maybe it was because he, more than any of us, was surrounded by brilliance and it inevitably rubbed off on him. Perhaps he had the kernel of brilliance in him to start with. Whatever the truth, he soon started to hold the attention of everybody around him whenever he was on set. It was inspiring for the rest of us. We followed his lead. And if ever there was a person you'd want to follow into battle, Daniel, like Harry, was him. He was great at reminding us, simply by the way he held himself, to take our opportunity seriously while having a lot of fun doing so. Even if I didn't always follow Daniel's lead in that respect, his conscientious attitude eventually rubbed off on me. I learned more from watching and acting alongside him than I did from any of the adults. When the time came for Draco to develop as a character, if I had any success at all in portraying that development, it was in part thanks to watching Daniel. Draco's development was not something I gave a great deal of thought to during the early films. We establish in Philosopher's Stone that he's the slimy git. In Chamber of Secrets, we see something of his privilege. He gets the best broomstick and effectively buys his way onto the Quidditch team. He's the kid at school whose dad buys him a Ferrari for his first car. He doesn't seem to have an ounce of humanity, but although the whole Muggle world learns to dislike him, there is no sense of his snottiness snowballing into something worse. As a result, I mostly spent the first five films standing in the corner sneering. I didn't need to think too much about Draco's development because there wasn't any. He was always the same. Then, in Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, everything changed. Through Draco, we see that the bullies are often the bullied. Very early in the shoot, the director, David Yates, took me to one side. "If we can just get 1% of empathy towards Draco," he said, "we'll have succeeded. Remember that you're planning to do the worst thing that's ever happened in the wizarding world. Kill Dumbledore. When you hold that wand, it's the power of holding an army in your hand. We need to feel for you. We need to think he had no choice." Draco Malfoy was the boy who had no choice. Dominated by his overbearing father, coerced by the Death Eaters, cowed into fear of his life by Voldemort, his actions were not his own. They were the actions of a boy whose agency has been ripped from him. He could not make his own decisions, and the turn his life had taken terrified him. The scene in which this became most apparent was when Harry comes across him crying at the sink before they duel, and Harry uses the Sectum Semper spell. It was one of the few scenes Daniel and I performed just the two of us, and I felt unfairly praised for it. For me, the genius was in the writing. But if I did manage to raise my game to follow Draco's development, it was in large part down to what I'd learned from watching Daniel. I couldn't get away with being the boy sneering in the corner. I had to find a way to put meat on the bones of the character. For me, Draco's arc in the final films gets to the very heart of one of the main themes of the Harry Potter stories, the theme of choice. It's an arc that reaches its climax during the scene in Malfoy Manor. Harry is disfigured. Draco is called upon to identify him. Is this Harry Potter or is it not? There was no discussion on set about whether Draco knows for sure if this is Harry. My opinion is that he knows exactly who it is. So why doesn't he say so? The reason, it seems to me, is that the boy who had no choice finally gets one. He can choose to identify Harry, or he can choose to do the right thing. At every moment up until then, he'd have dobbed Harry in. Finally, though, he understands what Dumbledore told Harry early in the story, that it's our choices not our abilities that show us what we truly are. That's why I see Harry and Draco as two sides of the same coin. Harry is the product of a family who love him so much they are prepared to die for him. Draco is the product of a family who bully and abuse him. But when they have the freedom to make their own choices, they reach a similar destination. Chapter 19. A Bop on the Nose, or Crab, Hagrid, and the Spooky Rubber Tom. There were hundreds of actors on the Harry Potter set. Some I barely or never saw. Others I got to know well. So let me take you on a little tour around Hogwarts, and I'll introduce you to a few of the faces. I've told you about Emma Watson's right hook. Long story short, keep away from it. But she wasn't the only one to plant a knuckle sandwich on my cheekbones, and from time to time, I gave as good as I got. Devon Murray played Seamus Finnegan. He was always brilliant on set, and a proper little Seamus. He was a real motormouth and mischievous, but kind. He clocked me in the face once, in a department store when we were on location. I can't remember why. Maybe I'd made some sarcastic comment. Maybe I was completely innocent and it was just the result of a dare. We used to get up to all kinds of nonsense like that. I remember somebody making a rancid potion of Coke, milk, and coffee beans and offering a quid to anyone who would drink it. So perhaps in a similar vein, somebody had offered him 50 pence to deck me. It wasn't personal. At least it was as impersonal as a punch in the face ever can be. Jamie Waylett, who played Crab, once received a childish bop on the nose in the Great Hall from me. That wasn't personal, either. It was just standard behaviour for the three Slytherins, who were thick as thieves. Josh Goyle Herdman was about my age, but Jamie was several years younger. It didn't stop us from being close, because Jamie was way older than his years. Like me and Josh, he was very into hip-hop and was an extremely talented rapper. But there was sometimes a sense that he carried around with him a kind of pent-up aggression. We were close, but we fought. In that sense, I suppose, we were in real life very much like the characters we played. Mostly it was childish over-exuberance. He'd antagonize me for something or other, I'd bite back, and the situation would deteriorate. We had lots of scenes together, which meant we had lots of downtime together. And you know how it is when kids rub each other up the wrong way when they've been spending a lot of time with each other. But the next day, it would be as if nothing had happened. We were just kids being kids, albeit leery ones. One day, though, we were filming in the Great Hall. Jamie was sitting to my left at the Slytherin table, Josh to my right, and Jamie was winding me up incessantly. There was no malice in it, and on another day it might have been me needling him, or Josh needling me. Jamie kept kicking me under the table and elbowing me and whispering under his breath that I was a twat, just as the cameras were starting to roll. Now, I was not entirely innocent when it came to messing around on set, but I did try to be professional. I did try to be conscientious. One of the things that the adults really hammered into us was that once the crew had spent hours setting up a shot and the cameras were about to roll, whatever it is that you're doing, you shut up and wait to hear the magic word, action. And just because the camera isn't pointing at you, it doesn't mean you don't have to act. In fact, your acting off camera can sometimes be as important as your acting on camera. Your reactions, your eye line, and your dialogue are ballast for whoever is on camera at the time. For whatever reason, I found Jamie's needling particularly irksome that day, so a millisecond before they called action, I turned and punched him straight on the nose. Not hard, but enough to make his nose leak a little claret. Somehow it was Josh who got pulled up in front of the producers and given a lecture about not riling Jamie. Talk about cross wires. Sorry, Josh, mate. When we weren't indulging in fisticuffs, though, Josh, Jamie, and I were intensely close. We were normally getting up to some sort of mischief. When we weren't, we would be indulging our passion for music. I set up a little studio in my trailer and we recorded quite a number of tracks. It was about as hardcore gangster rap as three white English Slytherin boys could spit out. The recordings still exist. Crabbe and Goyle's lyrical skills still astound me, and I listen to them to this day. As the films progressed, though, it became clear that Jamie's interest in filming them started to decline. He seemed to lack enthusiasm, to be despondent even. He pulled the same trick that I used to at school, putting his headphone cable up his sleeve and listening to music when he should have been listening to the director. It was an attitude that suited his character perfectly, since Crabbe doesn't give a monkey's about anyone or anything. But it became apparent to us who knew him that he was not having an easy time of it during filming, or even a particularly enjoyable time. And then things started to become complicated for him outside of the world of Potter. After we'd finished filming Half-Blood Prince, he had a scrape with the law. It was hard, after that, for the filmmakers to invite Jamie back for the final films. I felt for him. He'd been there from the beginning. And scuffles aside, we'd been mates. It was part of his character not to care about authority. But when that characteristic informed his own life, there was suddenly no place for him. I understood the reasons, of course, but it was sad. Our original Slytherin trio was no more. Robbie Coltrane, who played Hagrid, was one of the few actors I recognised when we started making the Potter films, thanks to his roles in Goldeneye and Cracker. Perhaps more than anybody else, he understood the importance of keeping it light-hearted. He was a joker, but he was also the person that the jokes happened to. Or rather, he was the person who allowed the jokes to happen to him, and his reactions were priceless. There was a phase when Daniels and my hilarious on-set gag was to go around changing the language on people's phones so that it was difficult to find your way back to the English setting. Robbie was definitely the butt of that joke several times because his reaction to it was so enjoyable. He'd narrow his eyes, peer around and mutter, "What fucker did that?" He acted as if he was ready to kill the culprit, but really he was just entering into the spirit of things. Robbie was always keen to remind us that we weren't there to cure cancer. We weren't saving the world. We were simply making a film. We should remember that. Not get too big for our boots and try to have a laugh along the way. He had a good dose of Hagrid in him. The big friendly giant who never lost sight of what was important in life. In the Prisoner of Azkaban scene where Draco is kicked by Buckbeak, he has to be carried off by Hagrid. All sorts of crafty technical wizardry was employed to make Hagrid look like a giant. Most of my scenes with him were not played by Robbie, but by Martin Bayfield, a 6'10" rugby player in an enormous animatronic suit. It was an incredibly hot costume to wear. Jamie and I were often told off for corpsing at the sight of steam coming out of Hagrid's ears. In this scene, however, Hagrid's face was fully on display, so rather than make him very big, they had to make me very small. They created a dummy Draco, about a quarter smaller than my actual size, for Robbie to carry. This was no toy. It took months to build and cost tens of thousands of pounds. But naturally, like any kid, I was delighted by the idea of having a fake mini-me to play around with. My immediate plan was to take it to a car park, wait for someone to reverse, and then throw it behind the car. Somehow, I managed to restrain myself from carrying out that practical joke. But my mum was on set that day, and I did take special pains to freak around with the spooky rubber Tom. Robbie joined in the fun. The more my mum squirmed at the thought of her youngest son immortalized in mannequin form, the more Robbie waved the decoy Draco in her direction, to the absolute hilarity of us all. That was Robbie, through and through. He had a cutting sense of humour as an adult, but he was brilliant with the kids too. The dummy Draco is now happily retired and living out the rest of his days at the Potter Studio Tour at Leavesden. Robbie was also kind and caring. In the first film, Hagrid takes Harry, Ron, Hermione, and Draco into the Forbidden Forest. Part of that scene was shot in the studio where they built the Forbidden Forest. Part of it, though, was on location and required a night shoot. I have a distinct memory of sitting on a plastic tarp on the floor at 2 a.m. in a cold forest with Daniel, Rupert, and Emma. Emma was only 9 years old, and she was curled up asleep next to me while we waited for them to set up the next shot. But while everybody was frantically going about their business, it was Robbie who kept spirits high and made sure that we were comfortable and warm and well looked after. In later years, my main contact with Robbie would be on press junkets and publicity tours. He's a real petrol head with a vast knowledge of mechanics, motors, cars, and planes. We shared that passion. But most of all, I always look forward to publicity appearances with him because you are guaranteed a lark and a laugh. Let's face it, Neville Longbottom was never intended to be the stud of the show. Matthew Lewis, who played Neville from the beginning, very much looked the part in the first film. He had the ears, he had the face, he had the endearing accent. He was Neville head to toe. But there was a problem. Each year, when we all congregated to make the next film, Matthew was ever so slightly hunkier, which meant that, physically speaking, he was ever so slightly less Neville-like. Fortunately, he's a very good actor, but it reached the point in the later films where they had to give him a wedge behind his ears, fake teeth, and a little fat suit to stop him looking like the hunk he was becoming. Who'd have thought that Neville would end up in his pants on the front cover of Attitude magazine? Matthew is a great example of everything good about Potter. He's a lovely, down-to-earth guy, humble to a fault. His knowledge of and interest in all manner of subjects guarantees great conversation, and that makes him one of my favourite people to have a pint with. Like me, he prefers not to watch the films back. Nobody likes hearing their own voice on tape, right? But he's developed into a really impressive actor and has a quiet confidence in his own ability. Of all the Potter alumni I bump into, Matthew is one of those I enjoy seeing the most. Any Slytherin-Gryffindor rivalry is long forgotten. There were certain actors on the set who you'd never really recognise out of character, even though they were absolute legends. They just looked, and I mean this in the nicest possible way, like slightly scruffy older men. John Hurt, who played Ollivander, was one of those. I'm a huge fan of his now, particularly of his performance in Midnight Express. But at the time, I had no idea he was one of the greats. You simply wouldn't know it to look at him. The same was true of David Bradley, who played Filch. He was the very opposite of his character. There was nothing malevolent or bumbling about him at all. Whereas some actors demand attention whenever they're near the set, David was always unassuming. He'd sit quietly in the corner, the very model of calmness. But I learned a lot from seeing how he could morph repulsively into Filch with such an expression of distaste and contempt. I always enjoyed watching his performance. He clearly loved his job. I was on set one day when I saw another slightly scruffy older bloke wearing an old pair of jeans and a t-shirt. I'd occasionally seen him around and I thought he was one of the cleaning staff. What can I say? He just had that look. We were outside the Great Hall, and I thought it would be a pleasant gesture to compliment him on his work. I squeaked my shoes on the polished concrete floor, gave him a thumbs up and said, "Top work, mate!" He turned around to see if I was talking to someone behind him, gave me a slightly odd frown and said nothing. Later that day, I was getting my barnet done, and the same guy walked into the hair and makeup department. He seemed to be showing family and friends around. Bit weird for one of the cleaning staff. I had a horrible feeling I might have made a faux pas. So when he'd left, I asked someone, "Who is that?" "Who? That?" They laughed. "Gary Oldman, obviously." I cringed with embarrassment when I realised I'd mistaken him for the cleaner. I wanted to apologise, not that he'd really have given a monkey's, but in the end, I took the easier route of totally ignoring my mistake and pretending I'd known who he was all along. In my defence, for such a big star, he was hardly starry at all. He was unassuming and down to earth, likely to be seen making a cup of tea for everyone rather than playing the room. Just as Sirius became a father figure to Harry, I had the sense that Gary became something of an inspiration for Daniel, helping him to navigate the tricky path of growing up in the spotlight as well as hone his acting skills. They seemed to me to share a very similar sense of humour and approach to the other cast and crew. I think some of us, myself included, were a bit jealous of that bond. We could see that, in part thanks to Gary's influence, Dan was really starting to learn the craft better than any of us. Who better to have on your side in that respect than Gary Oldman? Warwick Davis was another of the very few Potter actors I recognised at the start because I was a fan of the film Willow, now the name of my four-year-old, squirrel-obsessed, bottomless-stomached Labrador. He was there from the start of the first film, in which he played Professor Flitwick, one of several roles he would take over the course of the films. He was always quietly charming and fun with the kids. He became a dear friend of mine, and I had to admire his method of getting around set. Because of his height, it would take him longer to get around than the rest of us, even when we were kids. So he brought in a modified Segway to whiz around on. It was cut to size, so the label read Eggway. It was quite a sight, seeing Flitwick or Grip Hook sail past with a nonchalant wave and a cheery comment. Morning, chaps! But there's no doubt that we got used to unusual sights, surrounded as we were with the characters and paraphernalia of the Wizarding World. Chapter 20. A kind word from Dumbledore, or a breath of fresh air. As everyone knows, we had two Dumbledores. Sir Richard Harris played the role in Philosopher's Stone and Chamber of Secrets. Then, when he sadly passed away, Sir Michael Gambon took on the part. At the time, I had no real idea of what a legend Richard Harris was, as I had very little to do with him. He only ever said two words to me. He took me to one side in between scenes, just outside the entrance to the Great Hall, peered at me in a very Dumbledore kind of way, and said, "You're good." Nothing more than that. I don't think he meant to blow smoke, and I certainly didn't realise at the time that I was receiving praise from one of the greats. Did I think I was good? Well, I had a sense that I wasn't doing what everybody else was doing. Draco never wants to follow the crowd. If the rest of the students are standing here, he'll be standing there. When they're looking scruffy, he looks perfect. When their top buttons are undone, his are firmly fastened. A trait that I hated at the time, because what self-respecting teenager wants their school uniform to be just so? So the character meant that it was easy for me to stand out. But was that the same thing as being good? Did I deserve those kind words from the original Dumbledore? Truth is, these matters are completely subjective. We all knew, Daniel, Emma, and Rupert included, that we had a lot to learn. Sure, we knew not to look down the camera lens, and we knew how to find our marks, but it was the quality of the actors around us that made us look half-decent. Like anyone in any field of endeavour, however, I had my moments that went well, and my moments that were best forgotten. Tom's cockiness sometimes helped Draco come to life on screen, and sometimes it didn't. In Chamber of Secrets, when Harry and Ron have taken Polyjuice Potion to transform themselves into Crab and Goyle, they follow Draco to the Slytherin common room. Harry has forgotten to take off his glasses, which led to a nice example of Chris Columbus's genius. When Goyle explains that he's wearing glasses because he's been reading, I was asked to improvise what would become one of my all-time favourite Draco lines. After take three, Columbus appeared a little giddy as he had a light bulb moment. He crept over to me excitedly, pulled me to one side and whispered a zinger into my ear. "When he says he's wearing glasses because he's been reading, you say, 'I didn't know you could read.'" We shared a smile. And that was the take that made the final film. I knew it would, because Chris burst out laughing after calling, "Cut!" The following scene, on the other hand, was not my finest moment on set. The three of us walked into the Slytherin common room, Draco leading the way, reading the Daily Prophet. Draco had a fairly chunky monologue. I didn't know my lines at all that day, and it cost them a good few hours of filming. I received a very substantial reprimand from David Heyman, and a phone call was even made to my mum telling her that I had to know my lines or else. They ended up printing out bits of the script and sticking them into the newspaper so that I could read them out. I doubt Richard Harris would have been massively impressed if he'd been in attendance that day. As I became more experienced, I began to understand that the notion of being good or bad in a scene is more nuanced than most people imagine. You can act your socks off, but if you're not connecting with the other actors in the scene, you're not doing a good job. Just like whacking a tennis ball as hard as you can doesn't make for a good game of tennis. There is no individual good or bad. It's about the ensemble performance, about context and interpretation and opinion. If Rupert had played Draco and I'd have played Ron, would the films have been different or better or worse? Yes, to all the above. Everyone's going to have their own view. So I remember that kind word from the original Dumbledore with warmth, but I also take it with a pinch of salt. Much of what I exuded in those early films was the cockiness of a kid who was comfortable in front of the camera. The compliment felt good, but I kept it in perspective. I had far more to do with our second Dumbledore than with our first. Richard Harris and Michael Gambon were very different characters in real life. Richard Harris reminded me of my grandpa in many ways. He had a warm, quiet wisdom about him, so well suited for the part he played. Michael Gambon was more of a showman. He might have played the old wizard, but he was very much a young boy at heart. He was self-deprecating, but was at that age and stature that he could say almost anything and get away with it, however outrageous. He loved a funny story or a quick joke, and I think that comes across in his interpretation of the character. He gave, in my opinion, an incredibly impressive performance, especially in Half-Blood Prince. Most of all, he was a lot of fun. One of the cardinal rules during filming was that you were never allowed to drive yourself to work. I think there were insurance reasons for this, but much more importantly, the production people knew that half their cast would be late if they didn't have a driver sitting outside the front door at 6:30 in the morning, ready to take them to work. Not what you want when you're trying to herd 30 people onto set at the same time. There's an exception to every rule, however. And in this case, Michael Gambon was it. He was a car guy. He had a brand new Audi R8 at one point, and later a Ferrari. He'd drive himself into work and park the motor right outside door 5, which was just about the most inconvenient place to put it. I'd be getting my hair dyed, and I'd hear the revving of the engine outside. You'd best believe I was up out of that seat and running outside to check out Gambon's car with a head full of peroxide and silver foil. He used to let us kids sit in it, and although I'm sure he was breaking all manner of regulations, who was really going to argue with him? I mean, he is Dumbledore, after all. Gambon liked to play dumb. He would often put on a pretense of confusion. What scene are we doing, darling? Where are we? Which character am I again? But I'm sure he was largely winding people up. There were occasions when he had less than complete grasp of his lines. They once had to be held up for him on massive boards behind the camera, which made me feel a little better about my own occasional shakiness in that respect. It didn't mean that he wasn't taken very seriously. He was, and particularly by me, when the time came for us to shoot what was perhaps Draco's most significant and memorable scene, atop the lightning-struck tower in Half-Blood Prince. There were quite a few scenes in that film with Draco and just the adults, and this was the biggest of them. Draco has Dumbledore at one point and is summoning the courage to carry out Voldemort's instruction to kill the headmaster. I wasn't exactly nervous about shooting that scene. I was excited. But I knew that this was my moment. I was used to coming in for rehearsals with all the other kids, but I'd never been asked in to rehearse by myself before. That changed for this scene, and I reveled in it. So much of my previous direction had been limited to loiter in the corner and look pissed off, or watch the tennis ball and imagine it's a dragon. It felt good, finally, to have such a significant moment in the film. A piece that I could really put my mind to. So I rehearsed it well, and I knew my lines backwards. The big day arrived. For some reason, despite my preparation, I kept stumbling over a particular line. And it's a strange thing, but once you go down that particular rabbit hole, it's difficult to scramble back up. A little voice starts nagging in your head. You know these lines. You were awake all night reciting them. Why can't you get it right? And once that voice starts nagging, there's no turning back. A bit like corpsing on set. We did 3 or 4 takes, maybe more, and on each occasion, I messed it up. They called for a break, and Gambon magicked up a cigarette from out of his beard. He and I were often to be found outside the stage that housed the astronomy tower, having a breath of fresh air, as we referred to it. There would be painters, and plasterers, and chippies, and sparks, and among them all would be me and Dumbledore having a crafty cigarette. Breath of fresh air, old chap, he suggested. We stepped outside, Gambon in his robes and the beard sock he wore, mostly to keep it straight, but partly out of fear that he'd set it alight with his cigarette. Me in my full black suit. We lit up, took a few puffs, and then I apologised.
I'm sorry, Michael. I do know the lines. I don't know why I keep messing it up. I'm just a bit all over the shop right now.
He kindly waved my apology away, but I was on edge, and the apologies kept coming.
Really, I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know why I can't get the lines straight.
So he smiled, and he said, Dear boy, do you have any idea how much they pay me per day? At this rate, if you keep fucking it up, I'll have a new Ferrari by next week. He was absolutely deadpan. No hint of a joke. You keep doing what you're doing, son. Did he say that to calm my nerves? I don't know. But I do know that I instantly felt the pressure lift. We went back onto the set, and from that moment, everything went swimmingly. For the second time, I'd received a kind word from Dumbledore. Michael Gambon's method of encouraging a less experienced actor was very different to Richard Harris's, but it was effective. You never know until you see the finished film how many of the scenes you've filmed are going to be in it. Sometimes there's almost nothing. It was gratifying to watch Half-Blood Prince because everything I shot made the cut. That's a good feeling. Had I lived up to Richard Harris's early compliment? As you know by now, I have reservations about stating whether an individual performance is good because there are so many other contributing factors. Certainly, I received lots of plaudits, but in truth, although I was pleased with the result, I felt unfairly praised. So much of the effectiveness of that scene derives from the way it was shot and where it lands in the story, from factors that were far beyond my control. In between the time it took to shoot Half-Blood Prince and actually see it, I changed address. I'd moved out of my mum's house by now and was living in my own flat in Surrey, along with my beloved puppy, Timber. My dear friend, Whitey, moved into my old flat. He called me one day to say a letter had arrived for me. I immediately assumed it was a parking fine, but he said he'd opened it by mistake. It's from some guy called Joe, he said. Some guy called Joe? And it's got an owl on the top of the page. The penny dropped. What does it say? I demanded. I don't know. I haven't read it. Well, read it! Something about a half-blood prince? Safe to say, Whitey wasn't a fan. Just hold on to the letter, I told him. I'm coming round now. That letter from J. Rowling was the first contact I'd had with her for years. It was written on her beautifully gilded home stationery, said how pleased she was about how the film had turned out, and complimented my performance. Safe to say, that ended up in a frame, and is still with me to this day. If it hadn't been for Michael's unorthodox pep talk during our breath of fresh air, however, it could have turned out very differently indeed. Chapter 21. Alan Rickman's Earlobes, or Don't Tread on My Fucking Cloak. It's the sixth film, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. Snape has just killed Dumbledore. He, Draco, Bellatrix, and an assortment of Death Eaters are marching through the Great Hall as they flee Hogwarts. We're talking high stakes. David Yates, the director, has a vision. A V-shaped formation, Snape at the head, the rest of us fanned out behind him like bowling pins or geese as we storm down the aisle. Helena Bonham Carter has different ideas. She wants to dance along one of the long tables, kicking everything off, screaming and laughing maniacally. It's characteristically brilliant. Bellatrix comes across as being entirely unhinged. But we're having trouble nailing the shot for the rest of us. We do a couple of takes, sweeping quickly down the Great Hall with the camera team walking backwards in front of us. But it's not right. Alan Rickman is perfectly in focus, but the rest of us are a bit of a blur. We're too far behind him, that's the problem. David Yates directs us that we need to be closer to Alan. From the very beginning, Alan Rickman had certain suggestions about Snape's costume. Snape would, he felt, have extremely long, flowing robes. These were to include a long cloak that draped along the ground behind him as he walked, like the train of a wedding dress. Once David had given us this new direction, Alan turned to the rest of us just before the cameras were about to roll. His eyes were narrow. His lips were thin. One eyebrow was ever so slightly raised. Any Hogwarts student given the full force of that Snape-like stare would have had legs of jelly. And I'm not going to lie. Even we actors had an uncomfortable moment as we waited for him to say something. He spoke like Snape, each word distinct, heavy, with meaning, and punctuated by a long, agonizing pause. Don't. Silence. We glanced sidelong at each other. We wondered, don't what? Step. We looked down at our feet. Then we looked up at Alan again. On my fucking... We blinked. We blinked again. Cloak. We gave a nervous laugh, but Alan wasn't laughing. He gave each of us a chilly stare, then he spun round, his cloak billowing bat-like behind him. Released from his glare, we Death Eaters looked at each other, and one of us mouthed, "Is he serious?" He was. Deadly serious. We were, on no account, to step on his fucking cloak. We go for another take, bunched up closer this time. And who is it that's walking directly behind Snape? It's Draco, of course, and his feet will be just inches away from the trailing hem of the cloak as they march urgently through the Great Hall. The director gives us our instructions. "Chins up," he says. "Don't look down. We need to see your faces." Which means we can't keep a careful eye on the hem of Alan's cloak. So I give myself a good talking to as we prepare for the take. Don't tread on the cloak. Don't tread on the cloak. Don't tread on the... Action! Alan marches forwards. The rest of us follow. One step, two steps, three steps. Now Alan's cloak hung from his shoulders by means of a loop that went around his neck. When I inevitably stepped on the hem of his cloak, we'd barely reached the halfway point of the Great Hall. His head jerked back. For an awful moment, I thought he was going to lose his balance. His strangled scream rang out around the set. Ah! Cut! Silence. I gingerly moved my foot off the hem of the cloak. Alan turned. Slowly. I gave him my most apologetic smile. "Sorry, Alan," I squeaked. Alan said nothing. I really didn't mean to do that," I stuttered. Alan said nothing again. He turned his back on me. Shit, I thought. I've really pissed him off. A member of the crew shouted, "Going again!" We returned sheepishly to our starting positions. I gave myself another talking to. "For fuck's sake, Felton, don't tread on the cloak. Don't tread on the cloak. Don't tread on the... Action!" This time round, you better believe I was making teeny tiny steps behind Alan as the convoy of Death Eaters attempted their procession yet again. I made one teeny tiny step, two teeny tiny steps, three teeny tiny steps. Ah! This time it was worse. Alan's whole body juddered backwards, and he helicoptered his arms to keep his balance. Cut! Horrified, I looked down at my feet. Surely I couldn't have stepped on the hem again. To my eternal relief, I hadn't. One of my death-eating colleagues had overstepped the mark this time, and Alan was fuming. I'm not, he announced. Fucking, he declared, doing this again. After some negotiation from the director, Alan agreed to give it one last try. The Death Eaters and I shared a glance of panic, but thankfully, on the third take, no one stepped on his fucking cloak. However, if you think Snape looks a little strangled in that scene, now you know why. In the following scene, Snape and the Death Eaters escape to the castle grounds. Hagrid's heart is set on fire. Harry and Snape do battle before Snape reveals that he is the Half-Blood Prince. They'd built this exterior set at Leavesden, a massive hill like a football pitch on a slant. We shot the scene at night. Helena was somewhere in the background being crazy, doing her dancing maniac bit, having been mainlining espressos all night. Alan and I were standing in the middle of the field, waiting for Daniel to arrive. There is a moment when you're setting up a scene that can sometimes be awkward. They'll be lining everything up, and they'll put the actors in particular positions, and the actors will be required to stare at each other so that they can light the scene correctly. And then, between takes, while they're reviewing what they've just captured, it's the same deal. You're standing there like a lemon, patiently waiting for the call to go again. It's not always completely comfortable gazing into the eyes of a person you don't necessarily know that well. I tend to use the earlobe trick. I'll stare at my colleague's earlobe instead of their eyes, which somehow eases the awkwardness and saves the moment for when the camera is rolling. That evening, I found myself staring at Alan Rickman's earlobes. We'd done a take and were waiting for the director to review it. It seemed to be dragging on, and Alan and I were enshrouded by a long, awkward silence. At least it was awkward for me. I always had the impression that Alan himself was never uncomfortable with silence. Silence, in fact, was his preferred state of being. And although by this point I'd spent years on set with him, I was still rather wary of the man. It hadn't helped that I'd stepped on his fucking cloak. However, as we stood in the cold night air, I felt a typically British need to fill the silence. It shouldn't have been a big deal, but somehow it was. I eventually plucked up the courage to say, "How's it going then, Alan? You're right? Feeling okay?" 5 long, silent seconds passed. 10 longer silent seconds passed. I started to wonder if he'd even heard me. Should I repeat my question? But then he slowly turned his head and fixed me with that Snape-like glare. I held my breath, wondering if I'd managed somehow to offend him. We listened to Helena shrieking in the background. The wind blew, it was cold, we were tired, and we weren't allowed to move from the spot where our feet had been planted for the last 3 hours. A Hollywood red carpet, this was not. Very slowly, very distinctly, Alan intoned, "I've peaked." Then he turned his head to look the other way. But as he turned, I saw the whisper of a smile on his lips. And I realized then that, far from being the terrifying figure I'd always assumed he must be, Alan was a man with a brilliantly dry sense of humor. I didn't need to be wary of him, far from it. I needed to relish the time I had with the smart, witty, interesting man. At the beginning of filming, you were given your own chair with your character's name on the cloth backrest. These chairs would be with us for the duration of filming. One day, Alan Rickman was sitting around with Helena Bonham Carter, Helen McCrory, Jason Isaacs, and Michael Gambon. Even by Harry Potter standards, that's a pretty impressive group of heavyweights. That's the creme de la creme of the British film world right there. They sat in their comfortable director's chairs. I had a much smaller fold-up chair, as when I started the films, my feet would never have touched the ground from one of the taller ones. Almost immediately, Alan stood up. He walked over to one of the assistant directors, pointed in my direction, and demanded that I was given a proper director's chair so that I could sit at the same height as the rest of them. At first, I wondered if it was a bit of a joke, but it soon became clear that he was absolutely serious. "Alan, mate," I said. It's fine. I'm happy sitting on my shorter chair. He wouldn't take no for an answer. He didn't kick up a fuss. He wasn't impolite. He just quietly insisted that I was brought a chair of the same height as the others. It was a small thing, but I'll never forget that moment of kindness. Alan wanted a younger cast member to be treated like an equal to these leading lights. He didn't have to do it, but the fact that he did spoke volumes about the man he was. I think about that moment with the director's chair often, now that Alan has passed away. And not only Alan, of course. Richard Harris, John Hurt, Helen McCrory. The list of actors from the Harry Potter films who are no longer with us inevitably grows. When I think of their passing, I find myself in purgatory, because it's only now that I've reached adulthood that I've started to understand the effect that they had on me and how brilliant they were as examples. We barely notice the passing of time. There are moments when I still think of myself as the kid stealing DVDs from HMV. Then there are moments when I realise I'm definitely not. I'll meet fans who are closer to being unborn than they are to my age. In fact, most fans who approach me now weren't born when the first films were being made. I'll be on a film set where, far from being one of the scrappy kids, I'm the veteran. And it's in those moments when it's important to me that I comport myself in the right way,